Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the just-concluded International Climate Conference in Lima, Peru, where 200 nations agreed on the first deal that commits every country in the world to reducing fossil fuel emissions from burning oil, gas, and coal that cause global warming. The Global Director of the Climate Program at the World Resources Institute, Jennifer Morgan, joins us from Lima, Peru, for an update on the draft text from the COP20 conference, known as the Lima Accord, that will be used as the basis for negotiations leading up to the December 2015 Paris Climate Pact Summit. Then we'll examine the diplomatic flurry going on in Rome, where Secretary of State Kerry met with Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, then with the foreign ministers of Great Britain, France, and Germany, before discussions on Tuesday in London with the top Palestinian negotiator and the head of the Arab League. Mikko Peled, an Israeli writer and activist and author of The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine, joins us to discuss the draft resolution circulated by Jordan that France is expected to introduce to the UN Security Council on Wednesday, laying down a two-year deadline for an Israeli-Palestinian peace accord that would end the Israeli occupation of the West Bank. Then finally, with calls for the U.S. to invest $1 trillion to modernize its nuclear arsenal, we will look into the lack of investment in nuclear diplomacy and threat reduction with Michael Crapon, the co-founder of the Henry L. Stimson Center and author of Better Safe Than Sorry, The Ironies of Living with the Bomb. We will discuss the dangers of modernizing all three legs of the nuclear triad of land, sea, and air delivery of nuclear weapons without diplomacy and investments in non-military means of threat reduction. And joining us now from Lima, Peru, is Jennifer Morgan, the Global Director of the Climate Program at the World Resources Institute. Previously, Jennifer worked at E3G as Global Climate Change Director and led the Global Climate Change Program of the Worldwide Fund for Nature, where she headed its delegation to the Kyoto Protocol climate negotiations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jennifer Morgan.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
And Jennifer, this deal, for the first time where 200 nations have agreed to commit themselves to reducing fossil fuels emissions that cause global warming. Since you're there, is there a sense that there's a real possibility that the world is going to reduce this growing and looming threat?
Yes. A growing sense of the possibility.
Well, I'm sorry, we can't hear anything. The phone is breaking up. So, is there any chance of hello?
Is this any better? I'm sorry.
Yeah, now I can hear you. Yes. So, okay. Could you? Is there a sense that there is actually a breakthrough here?
There is a sense of a breakthrough. The countries from developed and developing countries have agreed on a draft negotiating text, and I think they're all willing to work together. Lots of hurdles along the way, but next year they should all table their offers of how much they will reduce emissions in years to come.
Well, but my understanding is that the 200 nations that have agreed to each nation being able to do what it can within its own domestic capabilities and resources, but not until 2020. Is there, in effect, a forgiveness period so the regime does not start till 2020?
This agreement will not start until 2020, but countries are already implementing either commitments under the Kyoto Protocol or actions that they committed to under the Copenhagen Agreement from a number of years ago. So this is, in a way, the next step beyond the existing commitments to reduce emissions by all countries. This one should be truly global.
But I understand that they have to. Each nation has to come up with its domestic plans by March the 31st. Is that right?
That's right. Every country that's able to do so the poorer countries might come in a little bit later, have agreed to table their plan or their offer of what they will do after 2020 to reduce fossil fuel emissions, grow renewable energy, reduce deforestation on the national level, and that will then be discussed on an international level.
So this is what the United Nations calls the intended nationally determined contributions, and they will form the basis of the New Deal to be signed in Paris in 2015.
They will be an important part of it. They will be in some ways docked into a new global agreement that hopefully will include a long-term signal to phase out greenhouse gas emissions to net zero, and a schedule that countries would come back every 5 years to strengthen their commitments. That's what they have to decide next year, is what is that architecture that it's talking into.
So what do you think made this happen, since nothing has been able to be achieved so far? Going back to the Kyoto protocols that you were involved with, Jennifer Morgan, it seems that that perhaps, was it peer pressure? Because there's no mechanism, enforcement mechanism, no mandates here. This is all voluntary, right?
That's right. I mean, I think it's a couple of things. I think, unfortunately, the impacts of climate change are happening, and countries are feeling those impacts and the cost of those impacts. So the urgency has risen. I think they're also seeing that, you know, increasing renewables and efficiency is good for a whole range of reasons. I mean, you just need to go to Beijing or even here in Lima to feel the air pollution from coal and, you know, car pollution. So I think they see benefits of reducing emissions in addition to tackling the climate change problem. And I think those things combined, as well as all countries moving forward together, is setting up Paris next year as a very important, hopefully, turning point.
Well, my understanding is that in Peru, in Lima, they must be feeling the effects of, what, a 30 to 50% loss of the glaciers that feed water to the country?
Yes, they're very dependent on their glaciers, and they've lost quite a lot of water. And so the millions of people living in Lima are very much under threat. And that's the case all over the world from melting glaciers. So the impacts are really becoming very, local, and I think people are starting to recognize the severity of the problem.
And again, I'm speaking with Jennifer Morgan, who is in Lima, Peru. She's the global director of the climate program at the World Resources Institute. And do you think, Jennifer, that the announcement recently in Beijing ahead of the G20 summit in Australia, where the United States and China agreed to a regime of reducing greenhouse gas emissions, This was somewhat unexpected, but it was certainly greeted by everybody as a huge step forward. And that's always been the problem, the contest between the have nations and the have not nations. And even though China is, I think, now the world's biggest polluter, they were considered a have not nation. So did China sort of break the ice here with the have nots?
Definitely. I mean, I think China's move to do this agreement with the U.S. was quite historic. Number one, because it did break a bit its alliances with other developing countries and step together with the United States. Number two, because, you know, China doesn't really position itself as a leader in any countries in any issue, certainly not with the U.S. So I think it was a real testament to both leaders of recognizing the importance of the world's two biggest polluters coming forward to try and forge action, and just the urgency that both are feeling. I also think both leaders are trying to position themselves for the new economy that's emerging, and China is certainly looking for that as well.
So some people are calling this the Lima Accords and the new regime that's coming out of this COP20 a climate conference of 200 nations that's just concluded now in Lima, Peru. They're talking about the regime as being a name and shame plan. So if everybody's joining in and they don't want to be shamed by being an outlier, going into it, there were some outliers, in particular Australia, which was the first country to adopt a carbon tax, which Vice President Al Gore considered one of the great step forwards. And then, lo and behold, there's a change of government, and the new Conservative government in Australia, the Prime Minister is a global warming denier. And he tried to have the issue of climate change taken off the agenda at the G20. He failed to do that. What's your sense of how countries like Australia are going to respond to the name and shame regime?
Well, I think the more that starts happening the key really is if the United States, if China, and also if India, if Japan actually start reducing their emissions and shifting away from coal, you know, countries like Australia and let's take Canada, which is a tar sands nation, won't have the market anymore for that because countries will recognize that they're going to have quite a number of stranded assets if they start building those coal-fired power plants or using tar sands. So I think the economics as well as the international isolation hopefully will bring countries like Australia and Canada into this agreement next year. But it's a bit of a dance. There's still quite a number of countries that are watching carefully and are not all that excited about this moving forward. So that will be a challenge for all.
But if the agreement, if this is the precursor for the agreement in Paris in 2015, and if the agreement, if there's a window up until 2020 before you have to do anything, is that a way out for the outliers like Australia? I mean, what's your sense of how strong the idea of peer pressure and naming and shaming will be if there's this way out of the deal, and, or you don't have to do anything till 2020?
Well, the countries are currently implementing commitments they have up to 2020. So Australia actually has a target that it is implementing now up to 2020. The United States has committed to reduce its emissions 17% below 2005 levels up to 2020. The EU has a commitment. So this is what happens after that. It's trying to build up. So it's not that they don't have to implement anything now. They're implementing their existing commitments. But this is time for the next round because if you're planning to, you know, infrastructure build, you need to know far in advance about what the emission trajectory is going to be. So I think that's not a particular problem. I think that the name and shame type of or peer pressure type of regime, I mean, I think that will need to be the start, and it's important in order to get all countries in, developing countries in. But I expect that will be strengthened over time as the impacts grow and as more and more countries come in and just don't want to tolerate others not acting.
So overall, just in the last minute, Jennifer Morgan, you're pretty optimistic that there's some real foundations being laid here.
I'm optimistic that there's real foundations. I'm worried that the level of effort is not going to be adequate, that, you know, countries won't put enough on the table in order to stay below 2 degrees, which is this global threshold where above that a lot of impacts happen. So much more to be done, that's for sure.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Jennifer Morgan.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Jennifer Morgan, who is in Lima, Peru. She is the Global Director of the Climate Program at the World Resources Institute, and previously Jennifer worked at the E3G as Global Climate Change Director and led the Global Climate Change Program of the Worldwide Fund for Nature, where she headed its delegation to the Kyoto Protocol climate negotiations. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into a 2-year deadline before the United Nations Security Council for an Israeli-Palestinian peace accord that would end the Israeli occupation.
In this sacred land, it has seen many hands. It has wealth and gold, yet it is fragile and old. And now the greedy souls just don't care to know of the changes it will confront. So speak out loud of the things you are proud of. Love this coast and keep it clean as it holds, cause the way that it shines may just dwindle with time, with the changes it will confront.
המחיצות שלך מפנה מקום בבטן שאוכל לבלוע אותך אני מפנה מקום בתיבה למכתבים שלך.
And joining us now is Miko Peled, who is an Israeli writer and activist, born and raised in Jerusalem. His maternal grandfather was the signer of the Israeli Declaration of Independence. His father was a general in the Israeli army, and in the 1970s, his father pioneered the Israeli-Palestinian dialogue. He blogs at mikopeled.com and is the author of The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. Welcome to Background Briefing, Miko Peled.
Thank you.
So there's a lot of activity now, particularly in Rome, where Secretary of State John Kerry met on Monday with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, after which he met with the foreign ministers of Britain, France, and Germany later. And then on Tuesday in London, Secretary of State Kerry is going to be meeting with the top Palestinian negotiator, Saeb Erekat, and the head of the Arab League. So a lot going on, but this is all being prompted by the fact that the Palestinians are going to introduce a resolution through France, a Jordanian resolution that's already before the United Nations Security Council. They're trying to get the sufficient votes to get it done by Wednesday. So this is going to be a pretty dramatic week, is it not? What do you think the chances are of the Palestinians getting this proposal for a Palestinian state with a deadline of 2 years?
Well, I think all is good as long as they're all enjoying themselves in their while they're meeting and traveling and gallivanting around the world. The reality is, of course, this will have absolutely no effect on Palestinians, and nobody is representing the Palestinians in any of this. We have the Israelis who are relentless in their brutal assaults and their brutal policies against the Palestinians. We've got the Americans who are paying the Israelis and allowing them to do this. And we've got Palestinians who represent absolutely no one. So this is all good and well, but the point is Palestinians' lives will not be improved by any of this one bit. None of the refugees will be allowed to return. None of the Palestinian prisoners will be released. Gaza, the siege in Gaza, will not be lifted, and life in Gaza as we know it right now after the massive assault that we saw this last summer is beyond catastrophic, and nobody does a thing. So this is all the theatrics of peacemaking, but it makes absolutely no difference to the lives of Palestinians.
Well, that's been the case for some time. Obviously, we have a peace process because it's about the process and not about the peace. But it seems as though at least the Jordanians, which is their non-permanent member of the Security Council, they put forth this resolution about a month ago, which now the French are going to pick up on, that forces the U.S. at least into a corner in terms of having to veto again on Israel's behalf. And it apparently that within the Obama administration, there's some questions. I mean, the U.S. is trying to work with the people like the Jordanians against the Islamic State. So when you say that it's all theatrics, it doesn't sound like the Jordanians are playing games. They're putting forth a demand for a complete Israeli withdrawal from the occupied West Bank by November of 2016.
They can put forth any proposal they wish. They know very well that's never going to happen. They know very well this is theatrics. They are part of the theater. They are being paid by the Americans, just like the Israelis are being paid by the Americans, and just like the Egyptian regime is paid by are paid by the Americans. None of this will have any effect, positive effect, I should say, on the lives of Palestinians. This is all theatrics. The only real work that is being done on the issue of Palestine that is serious, the only real work that is done on the issue of Palestine that has some chance of improving and affecting the lives of Palestinians are the boycott, divestment, and sanction movement, are the popular resistance protests that are taking place in the West Bank, the ongoing movement, the solidarity movement with the Palestinians, both in Europe, in South Africa, and in the U.S. And the name of the game has nothing to do with two states, because everybody who's in touch with this issue knows very well that the two-state solution is a code for allowing Israel to continue to do what it's been doing since 1948. The only solution that is a viable solution, if anybody cares to see justice and peace and wants to see the lives of Palestinians improved, is a solution whereby the state of Israel is replaced with a secular democracy with equal rights for everyone who lives there.
Well, under the current circumstances, that seems to be even more of a fantasy than the idea that we're going through this shadow game at the moment. Which is the more realistic option, calling the bluff on the sham talks on a two-state solution, or hoping somehow or other that a one-state solution is viable, when I can't imagine if Netanyahu's meeting with Kerry and he's obviously concerned about this French resolution that may get enough votes on Wednesday before the Security Council, and if they don't get enough votes to table it, then in January, Venezuela and Malaysia join the Security Council, so it'll eventually happen. So I don't understand if the Israelis are worried about and calling upon the Americans to get ready to veto yet again a Palestinian statehood resolution. It sounds like that actually they're getting closer to having a resolution, and the French picked up on the Jordanians. So, I mean, it's...
This has absolutely no bearing on the issue. None of this has absolutely any bearing on the issue whatsoever. Israel has complete control of the land. It has complete control of the resources. It has complete control of the people. And it will not yield unless it is forced to absolutely... sent away like apartheid was sent away in South Africa. None of this has any bearing on the lives of Palestinians, because Israel, as long as Israel maintains its regime, and really what Israel is an illegitimate colonialist racist regime that has taken over Palestine. As long as that regime is in power, there will be no respect for the rights, for the life, for the property of Palestinians anywhere. The only way that there's going to be any kind of change, now, does it seem realistic? I don't know what realistic means, but I know for sure, because the state of Israel has been in power, has been occupying and controlling Palestine since 1948. And we know for sure that occupied Palestine, as it has been occupied since 1948, the situation for Palestinians there is getting worse and worse and worse every single day by the day, whether it's racist laws that are passed by the Knesset, whether it's the brutality of the Israeli military force, this horrendous terrorist organization that is solely dedicated to terrorizing and destroying the lives of Palestinians, whether it's life in Gaza that's been under siege, this horrendous siege for years now. None of this is going to change unless it all changes. And the only way it's all going to change is by removing the apartheid regime completely from Palestine and engaging in creating a real democracy. Now, is it going to be easy? No. Is it going to be, is Israel just going to lay down and disappear one day? Of course not. But if we're serious about justice, if we're serious about the rights of Palestinians, if we're serious about the rights of all people, actually, who live between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea, then a democracy with equal rights, instead of this very racist, brutal regime that exists there today, called Israel, is the only solution.
Again, I'm speaking with Mikko Peletta, who is a Israeli writer and activist born and raised in Jerusalem. His maternal grandfather was a signer of the Israeli Declaration of Independence, and his father was a general in the Israeli army. And in the 1970s, his father pioneered the Israeli-Palestinian dialogue. He blogs at mikkopeled.com and is the author of The General's Son, A Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. But the description of Israel that you have, of course, that resonates, I think, in Europe, because the Europeans are getting fed up with Israel and this phony peace process. But that's not the case here in the United States. There's still almost unqualified support for Israel. And your description of Israel probably offends, I think, almost, you know, well, what do you think? I mean, people in the American Jewish community or Israeli expatriates that you know share your beliefs?
Well, if this was not an issue here in the United States, if things were not changing here, then we wouldn't see the Israeli lobby and the Israeli government spending hundreds of millions of dollars to combat this. The fact that they're spending such enormous amounts of money every single year, investing time and effort and whatever little talent they have in order to combat all these this image of Israel, which I believe is the real image of Israel, here in the United States, you know, this tells us that they are worried. And if they're worried, it means there's a threat. I think things are changing. Well, I know that things are changing here in the United States. Over the last 5-6 years, there's been tremendous change in the mood on campuses. The pro-Palestinian, the Palestinian solidarity voice on campuses in the U.S. has changed dramatically. The sentiment in churches here in the United States has changed dramatically. 5 years ago, you could not get anybody to talk with an anti-Zionist perspective in a church in America. Today, we have more and more churches that are either voting on or at least discussing boycotts, divestments, and sanctions against the state of Israel. And we see more and more church groups that go to Palestine, not so much for pilgrimage, but more and more to help the Palestinians and to be in touch with what is happening to the Palestinians. And many of them are now being denied entry because of this. You know, groups of retired people who come to escort Palestinian children, so they don't get harassed by settlers and by soldiers, are now being turned away at the airports because they are the enemy. So if there was no threat, then I don't think Israel would be spending and investing that much in combating this. You're right that in Europe the situation is far better in terms of realizing and understanding what is happening in Palestine. In South Africa, there's a very strong solidarity movement, and they know exactly what is happening. They can relate to the apartheid regime and to the need to replace it with a democracy. And other places, I mean, I've been to Australia, I've been to New Zealand. I mean, this the voice of the solidarity movement is growing all over the world. So it may not seem that way if you sit in a Zionist synagogue here in the U.S., in L.A. or in New York or somewhere. But those synagogues no longer represent American Jewry. I don't think they ever have. They are a part of what is, you know, American Jewry. You've got American Jews who are Zionists. You've got American Jews who are non-Zionists. You've got American Jews who don't care one way or the other. You've got American Jews who are Orthodox Jews. You've got the whole range. There's no one Jewish community in America. But I know for a fact that almost every Palestinian solidarity group here in the United States has many Jewish members, whether it's on campuses or peace and justice groups or otherwise.
Well, but your condemnation of Israel is very rare, particularly coming from an Israeli.
Yes, that's true. It's not as common as among Israelis, of course. In Israel and among Israelis, the discussion on an anti-Zionist perspective is rare, although the people that are having this discussion are very good and serious people. Many of them far smarter, much smarter and much more knowledgeable and have been at this much longer than I have. But so that's not to say that doesn't really mean anything. That's just the way it is. I think it's there's this the myth of Zionism, the myth of the Zionist narrative and the Israeli narrative is very strong. And Israel does a very good job both in Israel and abroad in order to make sure that that narrative is fed, sometimes force-fed, into the people that into both Israelis and Jews in other places. But that's, you know, this narrative is falling apart very, very quickly.
Well, but if you take your position, which the only viable and just solution at the end of the day is a one-state solution, which seems at this point incredibly chimeric, in the interim, you're also saying that these efforts by the French to introduce a resolution to create a Palestinian state within 2 years, that's a Jordanian resolution, and there's a good chance that it can actually be taken up on Wednesday if they can get the 9 votes of the 15. And it's already got the U.S. worried. That's why Netanyahu's meeting with Kerry in Rome, and then later on Kerry meeting with the European ministers. The French are pushing this. So it would seem to me that even if you say that the two-state solution is completely bankrupt and and in fact a con or a hoax. Isn't it possible that Netanyahu may have to make some kind of compromise at some point? I mean, if you don't think so?
No. Nobody's going to force Netanyahu to do anything. And as long as Netanyahu is standing at the head of this brutal, racist, colonialist regime that has been occupying Palestine since 1948, there will be no change. There cannot be any change. There is no West Bank, to begin with, geographically, demographically. There is no West Bank. There is no area. Now, the West Bank, by the way, is an area that was delineated by Israel. You know, it's not like there's some kind of a natural border there. Israel established the West Bank for reasons in 1948 or 1949 for reasons that it had, you know, for its own purposes. Later on, they decided it was time to take the West Bank, and they took the West Bank. It was, people refer to the conquest of 1967 as the occupied territory, as occupied Palestine, which is absurd. All of Palestine is occupied, and it is now called the State of Israel. The West Bank, the taking of the West Bank, was not the occupation of Palestine. It was the completion of the occupation of Palestine in 1967. And it was described in that way, and it was seen as that way by the generals, by the politicians, as completing the job of 1948. So there was not even, they weren't even trying to hide this. This is how they saw it, and this is how they described it. And we know that in the early 60s, there were already plans to take the West Bank and to impose military law there, Israeli law there, and so forth. So assuming that, you know, the best case scenario that the Europeans and the Americans and everybody was aligned on this issue, it still wouldn't matter because this is not something that Israel is that is even negotiable. Israel cannot and will not negotiate on the issue of the land because it is against the fundamental principles upon which Israel was established. And that is that the land of Israel belongs to the Jewish people. They couldn't allow a Palestinian state to emerge there even if they wanted because the land belongs to the Jewish people, not to the state of Israel. And only Jewish people are allowed to live in the land, to buy the land, to lease the land, and to benefit from the land. And the land of Israel is the entire country. It's all of Palestine. So it's an absurd proposition to assume that there could be a scenario where an Israeli government would allow Palestinian states to emerge. The best we can expect and the best Palestinians can expect from an Israeli government is what they have today. Very small areas with very limited autonomy, controlled by Israel, determined by Israel, and occupied by Israel. This is the best that we can expect. Now, the one state is not an option. The one state is a reality. There is one state over all of Palestine. It's a racist state. It's a brutal apartheid regime, but it's one state. It's all governed. Everybody's governed by the same government, even though they're governed by different laws. In other words, Palestinians, some Palestinians are governed by military law, some are governed by racist civil law, and of course Israeli Jews live in kind of a democracy, really, in a bubble. But it's still one state. So the reality is not that there's a one state or a two state. There is one state, that's been established, there's no way back. What we can hope for now is to support the struggle of Palestinians to bring down the Zionist regime and replace it with a real democracy. That is the only solution if we seek justice, if we seek peace, and to allow the refugees to return and to allow for compensation and restitution for the Palestinians who have been robbed and killed for the last almost 7 decades.
Well, of course, the Israelis don't see themselves as a racist, brutal, apartheid, colonial regime. They see themselves as a very successful country. So just at the end of the day, given the status of the Palestinians compared to the Israelis, which is sort of night and day, even though in Israel itself there are growing divide between the wealthy few and the less and less wealthy many, similar to what we have here in the United States. I'm not suggesting Israel is a paradise, but compared to Palestine, it certainly is. So what do the Israelis have to give up? They don't see themselves as racist, colonial, brutal, apartheid regime, but they certainly like what they've done to build this state, and I don't imagine they're going to want to give up any of it.
Yeah, you know, I don't think the whites in the southern states of the United States wanted to give up Jim Crow either. They didn't think they were doing anything wrong, and neither did the whites in South Africa. They didn't welcome the end of apartheid, and they didn't welcome the end of of legal racism here in this country, in America. But there's a certain reality which is stronger than what people may or may not want. I don't think Israelis are going to welcome this. I know for a fact Israelis are going to try to fight this as hard as they can and as long as they can. But that doesn't mean that it's not going to happen. This is going to happen in spite of Israel, what Israelis want. They're going to know, you know, there's this attempt, there's this argument that Israelis need to be convinced and that the fall of Zionism and the establishment of a democracy in Palestine is impossible because Israelis will never agree. Of course they will never agree. They're privileged. No privileged group ever accepted and welcomed ending the regime that made them privileged. However, there is a reality that is stronger than what Israelis may or may not want. And when they are presented with a reality of a real democracy, where they will go to the polls and their vote will count just as much as the Palestinian vote, they may well end up with a Palestinian prime minister, just like the South Africans ended up with Nelson Mandela, which really isn't that bad. And they're going to get up in the morning and see that the sky hasn't fallen and life goes on. And this is how it's going to be. There is no other possibility. I believe that if we did nothing, then this would still happen. I think we need to do something. I think we need to do a great deal in order to make sure it happens quickly. But I think if we did nothing, this would still be the reality because what is happening in Palestine right now is unsustainable, and no power, certainly not the Israelis and the Israeli government, even with American support, can maintain this.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Miko Peled.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Miko Peled, who is an Israeli writer and activist, born and raised in Jerusalem. His maternal grandfather was a signer on the Israeli Declaration of Independence, and his father was a general in the Israeli army. And in the 1970s, his father pioneered the Israeli-Palestinian dialogue. He blogs at mikopeled.com and is the author of The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the modernization of America's nuclear arsenal without diplomacy and investments in threat reduction.
Strikes now, so it would strike in me.
Well, did you feel that rumble? Did you hear that sound? Well, it wasn't no earthquake, but it shook the ground. Made me think about power, like it or not. Gotta work for earth.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Crapon, who's the co-founder of the Henry L. Stimson Center and director of its South Asia and Space Security Programs. Previously, he worked in the Carter administration on Capitol Hill and at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's the author of 20 books, including Better Safe Than Sorry, The Ironies of Living with the Bomb. And his latest collection of essays, co-edited with Julia Thompson, is Deterrent Stability and Escalation Control in South Asia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Crapon.
Thank you, Ian.
And we have a new Secretary of Defense who comes somewhat out of the nuclear business. He's a physicist and has had a long experience in nuclear weapons. And some of the analysts I've spoken to suggest that he may champion the so-called modernization of the triad. There have been lots of incidents of problems with the ground-based missiles, antiquated equipment, poor morale with the officers, the Air Force officers, and enlisted men involved with manning these nuclear missiles 24/7. So it looks as though the U.S. is going to go ahead and spend an awful lot of money on modernizing nuclear weapons. And I guess your concern is that they're not spending a dime on the actual infrastructure of nuclear diplomacy.
Well, I think we're spending, as a country, less than a dime for diplomatic threat reduction than we're spending a dollar for the nuclear enterprise. And it's very worrisome to me because regardless of how much money we do spend for strategic modernization programs to replace submarines and bombers and land-based missiles, we're still going to be in dangerous waters unless we rehabilitate and repair and modernize our diplomacy. And that's not happening. I, at one time in my career, used to work for the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, ACTA. And ACTA was merged into the State Department in 1997 to help Greece the Chemical Weapons Convention, get it through the Senate and ratified. Now, if you look up ACDA in Google, you're going to get the American Coral Something Society.
Yeah, the Directors Association.
Yeah. And ACTA is forgotten. The merger has not gone very well. And our diplomatic threat reduction efforts have been greatly diminished.
So let's talk about the distinction then between nuclear weapons deterring threats, but they don't reduce them, and deterrence without diplomacy is dangerous. What's the difference between deterrence and threat reduction?
Well, if we look back at our Cold War history, I think it's reasonable to conclude that deterrence did something for which we are all grateful. Deterrence helped prevent the actual use of nuclear weapons in terrible situations. Deterrence helped prevent major powers from fighting big conventional wars. And deterrence helped us to maintain sanity during very serious crises. So we can give nuclear weapons high marks for that. But look at the things that nuclear weapons haven't done or didn't succeed at doing. They didn't prevent border skirmishes, even between two nuclear-armed states, the Soviet Union and China. They didn't prevent these crises. In fact, they made the crises more serious. They didn't stop and stabilize the nuclear competition. That only happened when the Soviet Union was headed for the rocks. So nuclear weapons aren't useful for a lot of things, and they are dangerous. They're the most dangerous weapons in the world. And when one side decides it needs more of them, the other side gets worried. This business of deterrent stability, it's a fine concept that people came up with during the Cold War. But it was a myth. It was chimerical. It never happened until the Cold War ended. And nuclear weapons didn't reduce threats that we face. They don't reduce threats from North Korea. They're certainly not reducing dangers between India and Pakistan. And right now, they don't really help stabilize relations between the United States and Russia. So we're investing heavily in these weapons, but the returns on investment are modest compared to the returns on investment in diplomacy.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Crapon, who's the co-founder of the Henry L. Stimson Center and director of its South Asia and Space Security Programs. He's the author of 20 books, including Better Safe Than Sorry, The Ironies of Living with the Bomb. So how do you get established? I mean, apart from the fact that the diplomacy, nuclear diplomacy, has basically gone out of business, that the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency is all but extinct. It was, as you say, it was rolled into the State Department in 1997. And so we don't have any kind of dedicated bureaucracy involved with nuclear diplomacy. But how would a threat reduction regime operate as opposed to a nuclear deterrence arms control regime?
Well, in the diplomatic threat reduction business is still in business. I mean, it's still residing in the State Department, but almost half of the personnel, the civil service personnel, who work on these difficult matters are nearing retirement age at the State Department. But diplomatic threat reduction is also ongoing with the Chemical Weapons Convention, which has its own implementing body, with the International Atomic Energy Agency, which is in Vienna, that's doing serious and important work. So, and the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, even though it hasn't entered into force, is still doing good work 24/7, monitoring the absence of nuclear testing. So let's look at some of the investments that have occurred. The United Nations monitored the absence of Saddam Hussein's chemical weapons program and biological weapons program at about $20 million a year. UN inspectors were finding out that these dangerous weapons programs were not being reconstituted. The United States spent about $1 trillion, not including the human costs, by fighting a war against Saddam Hussein to confirm what these UN inspectors were discovering. We have spent the Chemical Weapons Convention that I talked about, spent about $90 million to dismantle Bashar al-Assad, the Syrian dictator, most of his nerve gas and chemical weapons stocks. Now, $90 million is a lot, but we spend that much money every week targeting the Islamic State in Syria and Iran. Similarly, the United States spends maybe $20 million, certainly less than 30, every year for this Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty organization that keeps tabs on efforts to conduct nuclear testing globally. Now, less than $30 million, that's not spare change every year. But think about what the cost would be if there were to be a resumption of nuclear testing. And after the Cold War ended, we spent considerable sums of money to help Russian scientists safely dismantle dangerous weapons and delivery systems, and to increase security at poorly guarded nuclear sites. Now, that money was supremely well spent. So the diplomatic threat reduction business is underway. It could do a lot more if it were better funded, but it's a stepchild in the U.S. budget.
So there's no question that the non-Lugar regime reducing the threat of nuclear proliferation from the former Soviet Union was probably the best investment the U.S. taxpayer ever made in American security and global security. But at this point, you know, Putin is actually sending off planes trying to provoke NATO and the West into some kind of military, you know, not a confrontation, but at least, you know, some kind of ginning up the threat. And, of course, he's destabilizing Ukraine. It doesn't sound like he's interested in threat reduction. He certainly, there's no way the Russians are going to, and the U.S. are going to continue their reduction of nuclear weapons, even though that's obviously the best way to get rid of them is to do it through an agreement with the two major nuclear powers. So I don't see that. But how could you get Putin interested in threat reduction?
Well, he's saying that he no longer wants to do this with the United States. And the most recent U.S. government budget, which I don't know if today if it's been approved by the Congress or not, but there is a reduction in monies for cooperative threat reduction that would go toward Russia because they're not interested. But there are still lots of places in the world in which we can do this work effectively. So we're now doing cooperative threat reduction in faraway places like the Republic of Georgia, which has just intercepted a cabal that wanted to get their hands on radiological material for a dirty bomb. This work is going on in dozens and dozens and dozens of places. So it's not Russia-centered anymore, but it's still quite useful. And I would argue it's also underfunded.
Well, obviously, what happened to when George W. Bush said the greatest danger is to have the world's most dangerous weapons in the hands of the world's most dangerous dictators? And, of course, it turned out that Saddam Hussein had already given up his nuclear weapons when the Bush, Cheney, Rice, and Rumsfeld were beating the war drums. And as you pointed out, the UN found out for a few million dollars what it cost the U.S. over $1 trillion to find out, which was that there were no weapons of mass destruction. But in the process, the U.S. handed Iraq over to Iran, and the agony continues to this day with the Islamic State, and we're going back for a third war in Iraq. So there's no question about the dollars and cents of threat reduction. But given that declaration by George W. Bush, there's an awful lot of bad actors out there that want to get the holds of weapons of mass destruction. That hasn't gone away. So how come our attention has gone away? Is it because Bush conned us and people we feel burned?
Well, President Obama has made pretty much the same statement as President Bush did. He's convened national security summits every 2 years to try and elicit pledges from governments to do better and to improve nuclear security. And I think he's made progress. But we don't pay attention to these things until there's one of these biannual summits. And even then, we don't pay too much attention to them. I wouldn't place the blame so much on our leaders, although it's their job to remind us that these problems continue to exist. But let's take a more recent example, one that has gotten tremendous attention and concern, and I'm talking about Iran. There are international inspectors from this Vienna-based International Atomic Energy Agency who are spending hours and hours on inspections at declared Iranian nuclear sites. And they have monitored the Iranian compliance with this interim deal that was reached by the U.S. and Iranian governments, along with friends of the United States.
Well, the P5 plus one are not necessarily all friends of the United States, Russia, and China.
They have been very friendly when it comes to training the Iranian nuclear program.
Absolutely. That's worth noting.
So I'll give Mr. Putin that, and certainly I'll give the Chinese leadership that. But here's my point. So these inspectors, and it's cost, less than $20 million annually for inspectors to monitor the downblending of enriched uranium so that it is not applicable for use in nuclear weapons. They have spent hours monitoring that more advanced types of Iranian centrifuges are not being used to enrich uranium. And these successes are partial. We don't know, for example, whether there are hidden sites in Iran, although there's no evidence of that as yet. And we don't have success in terms of getting rid of the entire infrastructure that Iran possesses that could at some point in the future be used to make nuclear weapons. That's what a lot of people want. They want everything gone. But the successes of inspectors are significant, and it would be hard to improve upon them with a military campaign whose costs are unknowable. We could temporarily improve on these IAEA inspectors. We could bomb these sites, but then we could be pretty sure that they would appear elsewhere in secret sites, and that would lead to an endless bombing campaign of Iran and other consequences that would deeply affect U.S. interests in the region. So we're spending $20 million to keep controls over the Iranian nuclear program, and people are considering that an abject failure, who want us to do better. And the way to do better could do a lot worse.
Well, that is, of course, you know, that is unfortunately pretty much the way it's been argued, you know, that you can preemptively bomb these programs out of existence, and it's never happened. And whereas the record is so clear on how, through diplomacy, you can actually get rid of these things on the ground and in their secret facilities. And the Iranian example you've just given us is quite a glaring one. So, and that deal may actually come to fruition. It's been stalled for a while, but it may come
It's been stalled.
Yeah.
And I, for one, think that the longer we can maintain these constraints on Iranian enrichment programs, you know, I'm not impatient as long as we can hold on to these constraints. And we may do better. Let's wait and see.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael Crapon, who's a co-founder of the Henry L. Stimson Center and director of its South Asia and Space Security Programs. Previously, he worked in the Carter administration on Capitol Hill and at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's the author of 20 books, including Better Safe Than Sorry, The Ironies of Living with the Bomb. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.